morning. I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Mormon. To my left is Judge Lance. We're here today in the matter of Martinac versus Nicholson, docket number 051195. Before we introduce counsel, I'd like to welcome interns from the BVA. I understand are out here. And individuals working with VA Rewrite. Special guests, thank you very much. Would the counsel for both parties please note their appearance for the record?
Landon Overby on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Martinac.
And who's with you?
Joining me at counsel table is Zachary Stowes, also the Disabled American Veterans.
Thank you.
Campbell Walsh for the Secretary, Your Honors. With me at counsel table is Ed Cassidy.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Mr. Overby, you will proceed first. Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time, if I may.
All right. So be it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. First and foremost, with respect to some preliminary matters, Mr. Martinac wishes to advise the Court for the record that he is no longer pursuing the issue of an increased rating for his bilateral tinnitus in light of the Federal Circuit's decision on Smith. Therefore, we seek to have that issue dismissed by the Court. With respect to Mr. Martinac's claim for an increased rating for his pulmonary disability, because the Secretary has conceded to Mr. Martinac's argument in that regard that the Board's decision should be reversed, we submit that the Court should reverse the Board's decision and remand with an instruction for the Board to award a 10% rating for that particular disability. There's no questions on that particular issue. I'll move right into the issue of an increased rating for hearing loss.
Proceed.
Thank you. Regarding that claim for an increased rating for his bilateral hearing loss, Mr. Martinac submits that the Board's decision should be vacated and the appeal remanded for VA to conduct an examination that complies with 38 CFR 4.10. In addressing VA's duty to assist, the Board concluded that the RO had complied with that statutory duty to conduct an examination. The VA examination, however, fails to take into account the effects of the veteran's disability upon the ordinary conditions of life, ordinary activities of life, including employment. The basis of disability evaluations is the ability of the body as a whole to function under the ordinary conditions of life. Mr. Martinac acknowledges that he underwent audiometric testing in November 2001, and that the tests included the average decibel loss and speech recognition percentage scores for each particular ear. He also recognizes that VA's standard procedures for audiology examinations require that those tests be conducted in a sound-controlled room. We submit that audiometric testing conducted in a sound-controlled room does not equate to testing or evaluating the effects of the veteran's bilateral hearing loss upon his ordinary conditions of life, ordinary activities, including employment. We therefore believe that...
How does that impact this particular case? Are you making the argument that the test is invalid with regards to the assigned rating, or is the argument related to whether or not the Board could properly consider extra schedule or rating?
Well, the primary argument, Your Honor, is that the test fails to comply with 4.10 and therefore it's unlawful.
Well, let me ask the question. How does that impact the regular schedule? If the Secretary has established a set of ratings, 10%, whatever, based on these tests, and he says these tests are done indoors, and that's what I'm relying on with regard to my rating schedule, are you contesting that?
We're contesting the fact that the examination done in a sound-controlled room does not ascertain the effects of the disability under the ordinary conditions of life.
And how does that impact the rating schedule? Are you suggesting that it is inadequate for rating schedule purposes?
The examination?
That's correct.
That is correct. It is inadequate. The Secretary can set out the ratings, which he has done so, and those are based on the decibel losses listed under the particular tables under 4.85 through 4.87. However, the examination, and we have to read the regulations in their entirety, 4.1, 4.10, and also the regulations dealing with hearing loss. And that when they're read in their entirety, 4.10, looking at the actual audiological examinations, requires those examinations to ascertain the effects of the disability under the ordinary conditions.
But doesn't the rating schedule itself take into consideration the secretary's assessment of what the average impact is on individuals? And if he's, the secretary has determined that a particular rating given in a enclosed testing environment equates to a 10%, and that 10% already considers the average impact, how does that affect the scheduler rating?
The scheduler rating, again, Your Honor, is dealing with the percentages, and I'm aware of 4.1 where it says that the rating percentages are based on the average impairment and earning capacity, but those are the percentages themselves. I think it would create a fiction that evaluating the disability in a sound-controlled room is the same as the ordinary conditions of life. We don't believe that it is. And 4.10 requires that examination to ascertain those effects.
If I may, first of all, let's go back to your statement that you believe that the test was unlawful, quote unquote. Hasn't Congress basically indicated that the secretary is to decide how to conduct hearing tests?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You don't think so? Okay. Now, as a practical matter, what would you propose? Let's assume that I work on an assembly line in a very noisy plant. Are we going to send BA technicians out to stand beside me and give me a hearing test? Or how would that work if you didn't have a centralized testing facility?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the answer to that is, in my opinion, rather simple. It's up to the agency to determine what type of test. There could be a multitude of tests that they could perform. There is today in existence tests that are basically called hearing and noise tests, which permits, being in their clinical studies, they noted about the environmental noise, the lack thereof, really does not give you an accurate picture. The hearing and noise test, for example, actually permits the testing individual, the audiologist, to determine the severity based on the functional effects of real-world noise. I think it's for the agency.
Well, but real-world noise is a rather a subjective term, isn't it? If I'm on my farm riding my tractor around, isn't that a different environment or ambient noise than if I'm sitting in my office reading your briefs?
That is correct.
Okay, but so how are you going to get to this subjective in the application of this? How are you going to get to this subjective test that seems to be advanced by you?
Well, I think, again, I believe that's up to the agency to determine which particular test they do, but we're suggesting that they have to comply with their own regulations, that you have to ascertain the effects of the disability under the ordinary conditions of life. And right now, as it stands, the sound-controlled room, as noted by BA in their clinical studies, as we submit a supplemental authority, they recognize that the environmental noise that's not introduced, it doesn't really truly reflect the individual's, the effect of that disability under the ordinary conditions of life. Even in their procedural guidelines dealing with CMP examinations, it's brought out along. BA has even indicated that the purpose of the CMP examination is to ascertain the functional effect of the disability.
Well, the VA is not the only agency in the world that has grappled with these problems. You're familiar with workman's compensation.
Yes.
Do you have any examples that you can give us anecdotally from other states where workman's comp administrations basically have adopted your approach to this?
I know that there have been federal law enforcement agencies that have adopted and permitted the use of functional exams, as they call them. U.S. Army Police, for example, permits an individual to undergo a test, which are required to take. But when they fail to pass that test, then they have to submit to a functional exam to almost rebut the prior exam to determine whether or not they could actually function on the job.
The DAV, did you submit comments or were any comments submitted along these lines in November of 87 and May of 99 when VA was wrestling with some of these issues?
I believe it's quite possible. I was not in Washington, D.C. at that time, but I would assume that we did. And I'd be happy to follow up on that if you would like.
Well, I was just curious. I mean, may have been a position that was taken some time ago in terms of the fairness of the tests, or it may be something that's just has arisen recently. But
I would be happy to look that up for you, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'd like to go back to the rating schedule itself. Doesn't the Secretary have sole discretion to establish the rating schedule? And if the Secretary said you get 10% because you hear at a certain level in an enclosed room, how would you attack that?
We're asking this court to interpret the meaning of the rating schedule. If that's the case,
the rating schedule says you get 10% for these particular ratings as they match together in this particular schedule based on these tests.
That is correct. And we're not disputing the actual percentages and the level of average decibel loss or the speech discrepancies.
All right. So on the testing that your client was given, he's entitled to, I believe, what was it here, 10%? 0% under the rating schedule. He cannot get any higher under the rating schedule, whether he's tested outdoors, indoors, or in space.
I believe, Your Honor, that if he's tested under the ordinary conditions of life, it can reflect differently.
But the schedule says he's tested under these conditions. I mean, they specifically talk about the tests to be given.
They refer in 4.85, referring to a state licensed audiologist. Speech discrimination score, as well as a pure tone audiometry. There's nothing inconsistent with 4.85 and 4.10. 4.10 still requires the Secretary to ascertain the effects of the disability.
But even if he had, it wouldn't impact the rating schedule, because the rating schedule is just a mechanical application.
The rating schedule is a mechanical application, but I think it's obvious in the clinical studies provided by VA in 1991 when they did their studies to determine certain effects of hearing aids, etc., that they looked at it and they said an individual who is exposed to the environmental noise, they're going to be extremely handicapped.
All right, let's assume the doctor said he's extremely handicapped. He still doesn't get a higher schedule rating.
Assuming that it's in the sound control room, yes. It's difficult to say if it's...
All right. It seems to me where you're going at is whether or not the board can make an assessment for an extra schedule rating, because the Secretary has already established the schedule ratings. On these two tests, as it fits within this schedule, you come out, it's a mechanical application, you get a 10%. The doctor could say, geez, when you're outside, you stumble all over the place, you have problems, et cetera. It's not going to impact the mechanical application of this test.
That's correct.
So why don't you discuss how it might impact extra schedule rating?
Is there any obligation on the veteran to assert his particular circumstances of life?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe, he's expressed his in the record that there is evidence that he has difficulties with his hearing. That's one aspect of 4.10, and that the examiner is required to ask of the veteran what types of effect, and they haven't done that.
How do you come to the conclusion they have not done that?
Because there's no question there answered. I think it would be assuming too much to say yes or no, and that the examiner shouldn't describe in there that the effect of this is this, or there is no effect.
Has the veteran in this case indicated what his current occupation is?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. He retired from the military after 28 years or so. I've spoken with him on the phone. I know what his occupation, but it's not the record.
What about record 351?
Yes, Your Honor.
Decreased hearing, especially left side, affects ability to sleep. Isn't that an ordinary aspect of life?
That is, and I can't honestly say whether it's referencing tinnitus or it's referencing the hearing loss.
How about referencing the problem that your client had? It seems like you're getting too specific. You don't expect your client to walk in and say, my tinnitus is what keeps me up, my hearing is what keeps me up. He went in, he discussed his problems. The doctor presumably talked to him.
That's
and the doctor wrote down what he learned or she learned, and that is affects ability to sleep, which is an ordinary activity of life. Why wouldn't we or the board or anybody review that and say, doctor doing their job wrote down how it impacts his life, and it impacts his life by inability to sleep. And there's no writing about other activity problems because there weren't other activity problems.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that just by saying affects ability to sleep, it doesn't resolve the question that the examiner is required to answer, and that's including employment. It's clearly in the regulation. And
well, what if there's no impact on employment? Are you suggesting the doctor has to go down a whole list and say no impact on employment, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no?
I believe he does, because otherwise we're left to assumptions, Your Honor.
Well, isn't there a presumption the doctor's doing their job?
I believe, Your Honor, if you're speaking of the presumption of regularity, the presumption of regularity applies to administrative officials. I mean, if it's a contract worker, an examiner should have to describe inclusion of here.
Well, what indications do you have in this record that there was other impact on his ordinary life?
The record talks about his other hearing examination that he had done by a private doctor. That,
and what does that say?
It indicates that he has hearing difficulties.
And does it indicate he wasn't wearing his hearing aid? About 396.
Indicates for this audiologist that the patient reports some hearing difficulties bilateral greater for the left ear. And
what about the recommendations?
Well, there's recommendation number 3 that talks about the amount of hearing handicap the patient is experiencing.
Looks like it'd be taken care of by amplification.
And, Your Honor, I would suggest that the clinical studies from that were conducted by VA even recognize that hearing aids don't actually probably hinder an individual more than they tend to help them sometimes.
Well, did this doctor say that?
Not in this particular case.
Is that in this record?
I'm sorry?
Is that in this record? What you just proffered to the court, is that in this record?
It is. It's not in the record.
Where?
In their clinical studies, which was cited in their Federal Register, which is not a regulation.
Do I understand your argument correctly that because of the requirements of 4.10, an exam conducted the way that this exam was conducted is inadequate by definition? And therefore, since it's an inadequate examination by definition, you therefore are entitled to an extra scheduler evaluation.
Well, Your Honor, I believe I'll try to answer it in two parts. One, yes, the examination is inadequate based on the fact that it doesn't comply with 4.10. Second aspect is if the court is inclined to not agree with that argument, then yes. It presents a case where it should be referred for extra scheduler consideration in Mr. Martinek's case, because it's an unusual circumstance to place an individual in a sound controlled room and assume that's the true effect under the ordinary conditions of life.
But don't both aspects of what you've just argued require the same determination that the exam is inadequate in order to get to the results that you would have the court reach?
I don't really.
It's either inadequate for 4.10 purposes, or it has to be inadequate in order to get an extra scheduler.
With respect to the latter aspect, I don't believe that it has to be inadequate per se, because by merely, again, as I indicated, by sticking that individual in a sound controlled room, because the extra scheduler ratings talk about unusual or exceptional disability circumstances. And the unusual circumstance here is the fact that he's in a sound controlled room. The adequacy of the examination goes to the actual scheduler ratings and how that
that presumes, though, as Judge Mormon was getting to, that the examination reports are inadequate, because if they are adequate, then the doctors, if they are adequate, then the doctors would have opined on the impact on his ordinary life, and from that the board could make an assessment as to whether or not extraordinary extra schedule rating or referral for extra schedule rating would be appropriate.
Well, we had made that argument in our brief that the examiner is required to describe those effects, and that the failure to do so also leads to the fact that it's inadequate, but primarily because of the conditions in which Mr. Martinak was tested, the examination is inadequate. If the test is going to continue to be conducted in a sound-controlled room, then this case should be referred for an extra schedule, consideration of an extra schedule rating, because of the unusual circumstances.
Okay. You have 10 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Walsh.
Your Honors, may I please the court? Again, Ken Walsh for the Secretary. The Secretary asked the court to affirm the January 7, 2005 decision, except as to the COPD initial rating. In making the court's decision, the court need look no further than Lendemann for its holding today, Your Honors. Essentially, the same issue was before the court, and it was unambiguously decided that regardless of the fact that Appellant has raised today, when it comes to ultimately rating Appellant, the court put its imprimatur on a mechanical application.
But isn't that only applicable for the rating, the general rating schedule itself, not for extra scheduler?
I think that's fair to say, Your Honor. I think that is fair to say. However, as for extra scheduler consideration, Appellant has not articulated a basis for it, but merely made an unsupported assertion of error without an allegation to show harm. Your Honor, Appellant wishes the court to say that all hearing impaired clients categorically should apply, should be given extra scheduler consideration. There is no other way to read what he has pled and what.
Well, what about reading it? What about reading it to say, we believe that the examination reports are inadequate. They don't sufficiently discuss the impact on his ordinary life. And because it doesn't sufficiently impact, discuss the impact on his ordinary life, they may argue schedule rating. That's one issue. But they also, it seems to me, argue that the board couldn't fairly assess whether or not this claim should have been referred for extra schedule rating, because that element is missing.
I understand that argument, and of course the Secretary contends that the examination is adequate as a preliminary matter. But that being said, Your Honors, the exam being adequate, there is no basis for this court to depart from its previous case law and what triggers referral for extra schedule consideration.
Well, why is it adequate?
This exam is adequate. Looking at some of the additional submissions that Appellant has submitted to the court, Your Honors, the court can see that there are procedures by which the examiner does take a history from the claimant for these examinations. And looking at the examination in the record on which the board relied, there was a history section taken. That being the case, referring to Judge Mormon's earlier query, the Secretary respectfully contends that a claimant does have a de minimis burden of bringing ever so slightly, perhaps, any sort of impairment that has any impact on his individual life that would trigger either total disability rating or extra schedule consideration to the Secretary's attention. In this case, the record is entirely bereft of any such indication. Furthermore, while the board did put in a discussion of extra schedule consideration, my reading of the record, Your Honor, and I've checked, I don't think I'm mistaken, I don't see any reference by appellant's representative before the agency that they were alleging that there were any criteria that might very well trigger extra scheduler consideration. Your Honor, it is the practice of the agency to refer these cases where either the record reasonably raises extra scheduler consideration factors or where appellant or his representative asked the agency to do so. In this case, the record contains neither, and appellant in his opening statement has made no such allegation that that fact is wrong.
Of course, if you're a veteran who doesn't understand all these regulations out there, and I think that's why the second prong is important, where it's reasonably raised. On 496 of the record, the veteran did say, "I feel my disability should be evaluated higher." Again, a veteran who doesn't sit down and read these regulations and study them, that statement might very well encompass at least the board to consider extra scheduler, and it may be why they did, because in fact, in this case, they did.
They did, Your Honor. I don't know if that triggered it. My educated guess would be that would probably be not sufficient, but even if it were not sufficient, as Your Honor mentioned, the board has made a statement and reviewed the record and determined correctly that there are no indicia. And appellant in his brief correctly notes that, you know, it can be more than the two indicia given as examples in the regulation. But, Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't see anything that would trigger extra scheduler consideration here unless the court were to adopt appellant's theory by which every hearing impairment claimant should be referred for extra scheduler consideration.
Let me back you up one step before we get to extra scheduler. When you look at 4.10, I'd like you to discuss what is meant by the statement that says this imposes upon the medical examiner the responsibility, and I'll leave some things out, to full description of the effects of disability upon the person's ordinary activity. And to be fair, I point out that the prior sentence includes ears, so I think this refers to that prior sentence.
Your Honors, the Secretary respectfully contends that in the rating schedule and in the procedures that audiologists are required to follow, this is covered. It's not that 4.10 is inapplicable. The Secretary does believe that 4.10 is applicable. It's just that the Secretary, through more specific regulatory provisions, has addressed 4.10 and then further instructs his examiners to take additional care, such as obtaining histories from the claimants, so that if any issue is raised, that can be brought to the rater's attention.
If we just had the audiology report itself without the history and the discussion that is in both of these reports, would that comply with 4.10?
Your Honor, let me answer that two ways. Strictly speaking, if it were this set of facts, I would submit perhaps not. That being said, there may be instances where the examination is computer generated and the audiologist has asked for history and gotten none. In those instances, I respectfully submit that the presumption of regularity probably does apply. So that categorically,
is there a regulation that requires your audiologist to take that type of information?
I don't believe there's a regulation, Your Honor, but there are internal guidelines that require it. And that being the case, I think that would be sufficient to trigger the presumption of regularity, as many of this court's cases involving the presumption of regularity.
We don't have those internal guidelines in this record, do we?
There are portions of the internal guidelines. Appellant has included a portion attached to his reply brief, and there have been 30B letters submitted with portions of those guidelines, Your Honor. Addressing some of the 30B letters, Your Honor, and appellant's statements asked them to them today, the Secretary would like to point out that the 1991 memorandum that was commissioned and sent to CMP, which was the last 30B letter submitted by appellant in this case. Your Honors, the court should note that in the Federal Register, and the Federal Register is cited in appellant's reply brief at a minimum, if not
is not only abided by the regulation, the grading schedule itself was amended to reflect those concerns. So it's not, Your Honor, as appellant seems to suggest, that there are these outstanding issues as to VA's hearing examinations. In fact,
Counselor, let me interject something. Are you aware of the April 2007 memo that was put out by the Secretary dealing with these types of examinations?
The FAFSA letter, Your Honor?
Well, I'm not sure what the format was, but it was a memorandum dated April 2007.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that basically confirmation by the Secretary that special care needs to be taken in these types of cases?
Your Honor,
and isn't that contrary to your previous statement?
Your Honor,